From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center recently brought together a group of scholars to consider some of the connections between philosophy and public policy. One topic was the ethical and moral obligations among nations. Speaking to that and similar questions are Robert Simon, professor of philosophy at Hamilton College and a scholar at the National Humanities Center. James Rachels, dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and professor of philosophy at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. George Schur, a scholar at the center and professor of philosophy at the University of Vermont. And Stephen Kahn, associate director of the Humanities Division of the Rockefeller Foundation.
Let's start with the question of individual obligation. How would people react to the argument that's often made that if individuals in the United States simply give food or give money to buy food to people in the third world, that will simply have the result of population increasing in the third world to make conditions worse than ever? Is it a good or bad argument, regardless of how it makes people feel? Does anyone want to respond to that?
I think it's a very self-serving argument. Mm-hmm. I think that it rationalizes selfishness. It makes it okay to hang on to what you've got and not share it with other people who need it.
But that avoids the issue. And suppose we were a community of saints, or a community of acknowledgers of whatever moral law there is. And suppose that we really were able to put our base motives aside, we'd still have the question, should we acknowledge this argument?
That's right. It doesn't avoid the issue. It's a prelude to addressing
okay.
the issue. I think, obviously, this is an area in which philosophy has to be informed by a lot of factual studies conducted by social scientists, right? Now, the social scientists whom I read and respect tell me that, in fact, the effect of giving or providing food to hungry people in the third world is not simply to increase the population, to keep these starving people alive to reproduce. We can, instead of just providing food, we can provide assistance to local agriculture. We can provide education. We can provide birth control information. We can help those people to improve their own lives.
Well, this is in fact what's happening. And yet the United States, or any country that does this sort of thing, frequently comes out the villain. Practically and philosophically. Why is that? What's gone wrong?
Well, one factor might concern the amount of aid. I believe the amount of aid, non-military aid, that goes to other countries is something like less than half of 1% of the gross national product. So we might be talking in terms of total amount. That might be a ground of criticism. Another ground of criticism is that maybe that we haven't always taken account of the kind of factors Jim is mentioning. I think it's more complicated in giving aid to the third world countries, because there very often are conflicts not only about aid, but about political philosophy, what aid should be used for, does the giving of aid free up funds for other purposes we might not like. I think the important point for us, one important point for us to remember is that, again, even if there are self-interested motives, we helped Western Europe so Western Europe wouldn't go communist. And there might also well be moral motives involved too. I think what comes out of this discussion, though, is that moral motives by themselves aren't enough. There are enormous complications. What kind of aid should we give? Should it be advice about birth control? Should it be an industrial plan? I was just speaking to someone who was involved with problems of clean water in third world countries. And it turns out that many of the engineers who worked on clean water projects did not take account of the cultural values of the people involved and did not prepare them to use the technological facilities adequately. And so local customs put all that effort for naught. So sometimes, with all the goodwill in the world, if one doesn't take account of factors of that kind, the aid is inefficient and it looks like we're spending money for no purpose.
Who said that the road to hell is paved with good intentions?
Smart man.
If I can get back to a point that Jim raised a moment ago, he said, we're rich and they're poor. Now, it seems to me that we're rich in possibilities, all right, but how many of those possibilities we develop depends on the motivation of people to develop them. They have to want to develop them. Now, you can imagine ideal moral agents, but I don't think that you're going to develop practical policies assuming that people are ideal moral agents. And I think we have that problem even nationally, because whereas we seem to be in a situation at the moment where the administration is pointing to huge deficits in the budget, despite the fact we are a rich country, we have a deficit of over $1 trillion. I don't know how rich you can be with a deficit of over $1 trillion. But if we've got that deficit, it would seem that we should be doing something about it. To do something about it, we have to make cuts. Not additions, but cuts. Now, to talk about giving aid to other countries is to add to what we're paying out. But what about cutting back? Where are we going to cut back? Is it to be from our own citizens who are already complaining that they are losing essential benefits that they have always had? Or are we to cut back in other areas such as defense by saying that that isn't so important? It doesn't seem to me that we can reduce the whole complex situation to a simple statement, we're rich and they're poor, and so it follows we ought to do certain things. It turns out that there are a great many complexities built into our richness. And at the moment, despite the fact that we are, in a certain sense, as you say, rich, in another sense, we are financially strapped.
Let me raise a further issue in addition to that one. What are our responsibilities with respect to the internal affairs of other countries to make sure the aid we give is used efficiently? And this has raised the question, which a number of theorists have been discussing recently, the legitimacy of intervention. Suppose, for example, that a country uses what resources it gets. Some help does indeed go to poor people, but as a matter of fact, the major result is that the gap between rich and poor becomes bigger, because the rich, through the apparatus of government, control the bulk of the resources that are transferred. How serious must the injustice be before we take steps to intervene? Is intervention justified at all? Do we accept the view that international lawyers have often argued for, that what goes on internally in a country, except in extreme cases such as genocide, is that country's own business? What steps can we make to make sure the aid we do give isn't just going down an endless tunnel? I think at least a minimal condition should be that the country involved is not involved in severe and massive violation of human rights, particularly human rights of the person, to bodily security. To be free of torture, to be free of extreme coercion.
How do you do this successfully? How do you tell the other guy that you're going to give him something with strings attached?
Before answering that, I think there may well be practical circumstances where some concessions might have to be made. After all, we did fight with the Soviet Union against Nazi Germany, and there may be less extreme cases where concessions and exceptions have to be made. I think you just refuse to give the aid. We've cut off military aid to several countries because of factors of that kind. The trouble with cutting off humanitarian aid, food, technology, is that it may very well hurt the people who the repressive regime is also hurting, and hence make it a double blow.
That plus the fact that you have no way of controlling it. You don't know really what's happening to it once the check is in the mail.
I think what this indicates, and maybe people here would disagree, is that very often international relations are so complex that simply saying I'm for human rights or I'm for authoritarian regimes but not totalitarian ones often will be too simple, and that very often we're balancing a lot of competing values in very complex situations. So I think just simply saying human rights should play a role in foreign affairs isn't enough. It's going to be very difficult to see how to apply that principle in a lot of contexts. But I would want to argue it has at least some significant applications.
Do you think that the kinds of regimes that would torture its subjects, therefore you might want to cut off military aid, would be exactly the same sort of regimes that would probably interfere with your attempt to give humanitarian aid also, so that as a practical matter, you wouldn't have to worry too much about the distinction there?
that could very well be the case. There could be a very high correlation. One would just cut off, since the humanitarian aid would be inefficient, wouldn't do the job.
Right.
It would simply be foolish to provide it.
Right.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to an excerpt from a discussion about some of the connections between philosophy and public policy, with specific attention to ethics and international political relationships. The speakers are George Schur, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and professor of philosophy at the University of Vermont; James Rachels, professor of philosophy and dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, the University of Alabama at Birmingham; Robert Simon, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and professor of philosophy at Hamilton College; and Stephen Kahn, associate director of the Humanities Division at the Rockefeller Foundation.
Granting we have an obligation to help, I'm still interested in how far the obligation extends and how we might settle that question. Specifically, you could put it this way. Does a starving person in some country in Asia or Africa count as much to us, imposes as strong an obligation to us as a starving person in this country? And if not, why not?
I believe that they ought to count the same. A starving person is a starving person. The fact that one happens to be located at a certain geographical point and another at a different geographical point is not a relevant consideration from a moral point of view. I want to know what is my relationship with someone in Kansas or Arizona that their life should somehow be regarded by me as more worthy or more deserving than the life of someone in Mexico or Buenos Aires. I think it's very important to remember that the individuals who will be helped by my aid may be no less deserving, no more worthy as human beings because they happen to be in a foreign country than in this country.
Maybe one thing to say here is that we could have obligations of very different sorts to provide aid in a given case. In particular, you might say that on the one hand, there is an obligation that stems from the fact that we're part of the same polity, that we're part of the same social enterprise, live under the same constitution, under the same elected government, and so forth. And you might also say that there's another obligation quite distinct from that, which is an obligation of humaneness or something like that, to respond to suffering wherever it is. So that the second obligation, of course, is not affected by where a person lives, but the first one is.
Mm-hmm. Well, still, if one allowed those as distinct obligations, the argument might go that towards someone in one's own country, you had both kinds of obligations. Whereas toward someone in another country, you only have the latter. Therefore, all things considered, your obligation toward someone in your own country is greater.
And you don't feel totally comfortable with that conclusion?
I don't understand the nature of the obligation that's engendered by the fact that we live in the same country. I agree that intuitively that's a very appealing idea. One can talk about the sort of enterprise that we in the same country are loosely all engaged in, but one could conceptualize different enterprises and talk about the enterprises that all humans are jointly engaged in, or all Southerners, or all New Englanders, or all Georgians, or all Californians. There's so many ways of cutting up the family of mankind. National boundaries are only one kind of boundaries. I wonder whether it isn't arbitrary to fix on national boundaries as the most significant. I mean, are there obligations that Jewish people have, especially to other Jewish people, that Christian people have to other Christians in other countries because they're part of a common enterprise that aren't shared, that isn't shared by everyone. Democrats or socialists across national boundaries. I mean, what's special about national boundaries? That, I guess, brings us back to the to the question that we started with about the morality of international relations. What?
I think the problems you're raising are very serious ones. Perhaps one start that might be made, and if one wanted to make a case that nations generate special obligations, is that nations, after all, are the largest and most powerful organizations that are concerned with three pretty essential functions: personal security, welfare, and in at least some countries, at least, trying to realize a broad political ideal. And while I think we can concede that there may be a whole cross current of obligations to many different groups, doesn't the special function of the state create not always overriding obligations, but at least a set that have some special significance or weight?
You can add something to that too, and that is that nations are organizations in some fairly strong sense. That is, they're functionally organized, and their elements are functionally interdependent in a way that that other groups are not. Now, of course, exactly what the moral import of that is remains to be spelled out, but I think it looks promising.
Bertrand Russell at one point talked about the difficulty of feeling obligations to people far from us and how easy it was to feel obligations toward those close to us. I've often found the opposite to be the case, that in fact it's easy to feel obligations to people very far from us, but very difficult to feel obligations toward people close to us.
That's what Charles Dickens' novels are.
That's right. Mrs. Jellybee in Bleak House felt these obligations toward people very far away.
Society for Bula Bula Ga.
One of the reasons for that is I think obligations toward people close to us can really require tremendous amounts of effort on our part, self-denial sometimes. It's hard to know what more one can do from a practical point of view for someone halfway across the globe, halfway around the globe, than to provide some money when asked. Even if one provides quite a bit of money when asked, it wouldn't be practical for all of us simply to pick up and go over there, and even if we did, we wouldn't solve the problem, we'd create a problem.
That's right.
So, to think about it, to be aware of it, to provide funds or clothing when asked, to vote for actions that will help these people, that's about the limit of what we can do. We can join organizations and spend some time and try to encourage these things within our democratic community, but compare that for a minute with what's required of you. If a member of your family ends up in a personal difficulty which can cause enormous travail, in which you have to devote hour after hour of day after day to assisting that person, to working with that person, to caring deeply for that person, that may be far more trying on you than is your obligation toward someone halfway around the globe.
What are the obligations of this country let's talk about the Third World specifically?
First of all, I think we whether the moral obligations to help people in other countries are equal to moral obligations to people in our family, our city, our region, or our nation, it seems to me we do have obligations both of a humanitarian sort, and I would think some obligations of distributive justice to help remedy some of the evil and suffering found in parts of the world. On the other hand, I think our discussion brings out, simply realizing that we have such obligations, that premise alone doesn't simply to use a phrase that unfortunately has become all too popular, that we can solve problems simply by throwing money at them. I mean, we have to do things intelligently. We have to take account of the complexities. The danger, of course, is that the complexities will seem so great that we end up doing nothing. But of course, there's also a danger on the other hand. If we don't take account of the complexities, we might as well have done nothing. We might even make things worse. This means it's very, very difficult to steer the right course. And because of that, some people might despair. I think it's crucial to say, however, that if we go the other way, and I don't think complexity should discourage us about the possibility of being moral in international affairs. If it did, we should be just as skeptical about following self-interest. It's just as controversial what our self-interest really is and how we can realize it in lots of cases. So self-interest is no less complex than moral issues. I think that's absolutely important.
What's the special obligation of philosophers? What do philosophers need to say about the connections between the United States and the Third World?
What we'd like to see, I think, is a theory. What we'd like is a theory that knits up and integrates the obligations that we as individuals have towards other individuals in this country, that we as individuals have towards other individuals outside this country, that we as individuals have towards our government, that our government has towards us, that our government has towards individuals outside this country, that our government has towards other governments, that shows the interconnections of all of those obligations, that shows which obligations take precedence over which other obligations, and how the whole mess is grounded. That's what we'd like to find. I suspect we'll be looking for it for a while.
In the meantime, though, I wonder if there's something else philosophers might be doing, and that is, I think, publicly raising these issues, getting people to talk about them and to examine their positions. I don't think one can expect everything of philosophers. Philosophers probably don't have any special expertise, although I don't think they have any special inexpertise, if that's a word, about talking about what policies might work in what specific countries. However, I think they can help subject the general rationales that are given in public life to critical scrutiny and make people aware of alternate positions, the questions we've been talking about. That's what we do in the classroom, and I don't see why it couldn't be done in public life as well.
Constructing theories is one thing that philosophy does. Philosophy also serves a very important function of social criticism. Philosophy identifies and critically examines the deepest assumptions that people make in their thinking. In this area, people have always drawn lines and have said that human beings on one side of the line are more morally important, have more claims on us than people on the other side of the line. These lines have been drawn along religious lines, national boundaries, along racial lines. I think one of the things that philosophers can do that's very important is to identify the assumptions that are being made here and raise questions about whether these assumptions are valid. We have now come to realize that the line that used to be drawn between black and white is not valid from a moral point of view. It would have been astonishing 200 years ago for people to have been told, no, the difference between black and white is really not a very important difference from a moral point of view. Now, I think the difference between the difference between American and Chinese, between American and Russian, between American and Yugoslavian or whatever, I think we have to examine whether that difference is important from a moral point of view. Perhaps it is. Perhaps the difference made between being a member of one political community as against another political community, the fact that someone is our fellow citizen, whereas a person in another country is not our fellow citizen, perhaps that's important. But it requires very careful analysis to figure out why it's important and exactly what difference this makes. I think that we probably assume too easily that it makes more of a difference than it really does. I think philosophical thought can help in sorting those issues out.
From the National Humanities Center, this has been an excerpt from a discussion of philosophy, public policy, and international political relations. The speakers were James Rachels, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and Professor of Philosophy at the University of Alabama in Birmingham, Robert Simon, a scholar at the Center and Professor of Philosophy at Hamilton College, Stephen Kahn, Associate Director of the Humanities Division of the Rockefeller Foundation, and George Schur, a scholar at the Center and Professor of Philosophy at the University of Vermont. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The belief that moral value should be taught to American youngsters is as old as the country itself. But what's the status of moral education today? William Bennett, director of the National Humanities Center, offers this comment.
All over the country, in elementary and secondary schools, there are programs that have been set up to practice what is called values education. I've seen over 50 of these programs in action in various schools around the country, and with few exceptions, I believe these programs do much more harm than they do good. The first difficulty with them is the term values itself. When I hear the word values, it reminds me of spring sales at Sears, the shower of values, or of a phase in the history of economics, the so-called labor theory of value. The word value is now often used with the verb have, as if one had values like one has neckties or hoop skirts or the chicken pox. It is used with get, getting values, again as if one got good values like one gets the measles. Well, my point is, values, schmalues. Character is what we're really after, and character is not a consumer item. I think it's very important that we talk about such things correctly and use the right words. How we talk of such things is important. Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, "The corruption of language is followed by the corruption of man." So I would prefer to talk about character than to talk about values. Now, there's no way, I think, that you can do anything about the formation of character in the young unless you have at hand people who know the difference between right and wrong, good and bad and evil, and who make some effort to live that difference. That's the nub of it. That's the necessary and often the sufficient condition of teaching such things. There's no substitute. There is no margarine that will take the place of butter here. There is no special curriculum, no values education program. There is no course. There is nothing that has the moral power of the good example of others. So unless there are men and women of character, there will be no worthy teaching of it. If you want young people to possess character, put them in school in the presence of people who have character, and then hope that the parents at home have some too. If you do this, you cannot guarantee that the children will grow to have character. But if you don't do it, you're making it only a matter of small chance and dim luck that students will discover what it means to be a person of character. I think the remarks of Jeremy Bentham on being comfortable capture my point well. Bentham says, "The way to be comfortable is to make others comfortable. The way to make others comfortable is to appear to love them. The way to appear to love them is to love them in reality." In the same way, the way to teach character is to have character and to take an interest in the character of those whom you teach. Shoddy programs and values education are only a dim shadow of the real moral commerce that ought to go on between children and adults.
William Bennett is director of the National Humanities Center.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the Center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for Soundings. This week's program looks at the frequently tenuous place of ethics in international diplomacy and political relations. Is it possible for governments to behave ethically, given constraints of self-interest or self-protection? Soundings will also provide a commentary about the current interest in moral education for American youngsters. Please join me this week for Soundings.